except these.
You're listening to Excellent Radio.
That's too bad.
And normally we would be listening to Artie Shaw do Pied Piper, and we would be yelling out at Jean Melter about artsy people, but she's not here today. Took this week off doing some traveling, and we just said, hey, well, this is an excellent opportunity to begin what we've been putting off for way too long. A discussion about the Do Nights. And I have a couple of people here who deep dish. That's how I would describe their connection to the Do Nights and everything we'll be talking about. And that would be Mark Whedon and Norm Hammond. So they're sitting in here with me. Can you guys hear me okay? Go ahead and give me a blast, Norm.
I can hear you just fine.
That sounds pretty good. And Mark, are you still there?
I can hear you, Charlie, real good.
And I can hear you real well. I'm going to pull these birds down. We don't have any particular theme music today. It won't be necessary. The birds are, I think, probably as good a song to ride in on, considering we're talking about the nature of the dunes. And I think what we'll do here, there are so many subjects that we could cover with Do Nights, and you'll find that out in this next hour, that we just decided this wasn't going to be the definitive show by any means. Instead, we're going to use this opportunity to kind of paint a picture of the Do Nights and what they were connected to, and some of the subjects that we'll be more or less covering in depth over the next couple of months. And we're going to put this on our archive page on our website so that people can continue to learn about the Do Nights. And I don't know if you noticed, we have the first mural in Grover Beach, and it is, of course, a Do Night theme. It's Elwood Deckard's A Dune Goddess Scattering Bubbles of Illusion to Entertain and Instruct Children Like Us, from 1939. And here's a footnote. The reason I even started the Excellent Center was because of Elwood. When he passed, my friend Verona and I both said, he's got so much work already in the can and nobody knows about it. We need to do something to get that out. And you'll find out about the many things that Elwood was into as the show proceeds here. But we took the other half of this building that's connected to Hole in the Sky, and we gutted it, and a number of people volunteered to turn it into an art center, and it was a very successful art center. I believe we started in March of 92 after Elwood passed, and we had many shows, and it developed a radio station. By 1995, we found ourselves in the middle of an art project that turned into Excellent Radio, and that Excellent Radio, it spawned what we have today as Excellent Radio. 3 years on the air, doing city council meetings, providing entertainment and education and connection to the community. And we have to thank Elwood and the Do Nights for that. So there's more than enough historical precedents established here. And I have lived on land that was owned by Gavin Arthur and the Do Nights and Mrs. Grell for many, many, many years, since like 1976. And that's where I met Norm Hammond, who had become, because he's eternally curious, an archivist of the Do Night experience. Norm, can you give me a little bit of background as to how you came stumbling across what we now see as a mountain of historical perspectives?
I guess you could say this started back in the 1970s, in the mid-70s, when I was hiking around in what is today the Oceano Dune Preserve, which is immediately south of Rio Grande Creek, which also forms the southern boundary of Oceano. I spent a lot of time hiking around in there, and I noted that it was the kind of a place where you could not have to have much in the way of a shelter to just live there. It never gets very cold and doesn't get very hot. And I could see signs of the presence of the Chumash Indians pretty much everywhere in evidence. And so they lived here for a long, long time and got fish from the sea. And one day I came across a willow thicket in the dune preserve, and I saw a column of smoke coming out of it. And so I went ahead and thought maybe there's a fire going here that somebody should pay attention to. I was a firefighter at the time, so that was kind of a natural response. But it didn't seem to be getting any bigger, didn't seem to be getting any smaller, and more importantly, I couldn't even find a way to get in there to see what was going on. So my curiosity level kind of ramped up a little higher. I became more resolved, and pretty soon I could see that there was a trail in there, but you kind of had to get down on hands and knees just to get past that part where you couldn't see in. So I did that, and got back on the trail and went back in there, and I could see it opened into a clearing, and there was a fellow there with his back turned, and he was doing laundry. He had a wash tub, big galvanized wash tub, over an open fire, and I could see he had clothes on a line. I could see he had two buildings there. I could see he had a garden. This is all a pretty wide open space, and I knew he had been there for a long time. I could tell just by looking at him. So I waited for him to turn around, and after a while, he did turn around, and he saw me, and he turned away. And I sensed that he wanted to be left alone, which, of course, I respected, and just kind of quietly backed out. And that was the end of that. I had previously read a book, The Face of the Clam, that was written in 1947, which is written about the Dunites. And on the very front page, he had a disclaimer saying that there never were any Dunites, both living or dead, and any resemblance is purely coincidental, and all that standard disclaimer that you see in books. But on the very same page, if you drop down an inch or so, he pays homage to that great Dunite, Edward C. St. Clair, for the use of his poem, End of the Trail, which was in the last chapter of the book. I had read the book and wondered about that little thing, and so I thought there's something strange going on here, because he says there never was any Dunites. His was the only book around about the Dunites that I knew of. In fact, the only book that I ever read that had anything about Oceano in it. So I puzzled about that until about 2 weeks later, there was a big article in the Santa Maria Times by a local reporter, Doris Olson, and it described the last of the Dunites having died, and his name was Bert Skivink, and he was indeed the person I had stumbled across in the clearing. So that kind of ramped my curiosity up, and the story kind of really goes from right there. I started asking around about anybody who might have known about these people, and of course nobody did. Back in the day, when they were in abundance out there, they kind of only came to town when they had to for staples, you know, coffee, cigarettes, and maybe a bottle of wine. That was it. And so they weren't generally known about even then. Time went by. I'm still floundering around asking people, interviewing anybody I know, because I was really curious about this. Why is there no record of these people? And I saw in the local newspaper, South County Recorder, Press Recorder, that this Dr. Rudolph Gerber was going to give a talk on the Dunites. So I made sure I was there in attendance, and I was totally blown away as the story started evolving. And I made arrangements to go interview him after the program, and I did. And we became pretty good friends over a period of years. He turned me on to the people who were still surviving, because he was, during that time period, 30s, 40s, up into the 50s, kind of like the center of a hub of a big wheel. And anybody who was involved with wanting to go to the dunes would go to his house and for directions and to find out about other people. So the story kind of unfolded right there at that point, and that's where I went with it and finally published my book, The Dunites, and that's been a while back, 1992. But information keeps coming in, so there's always more stuff to add, and that's basically how I got involved in the story, and I'm basically still involved in the story.
I like to say that I feel it's the Dunites are the missing link in American history, and you made a strong case for missing. just the fact that somebody said it didn't exist, and you know darn well that it did exist, and you've been pursuing it, and they talk about sweeping stuff under the rug. Boy, have we found some stuff under the rug. And when Elwood passed, it opened up an even larger exploration, I guess you could say, because we were ready to do a Dunite show here at the Excellence Center. And more and more people that had experiences in the dunes came to those shows and filled in the blanks, and the artwork started to pour in, and we got some really interesting perspectives on the Dunites, which if there was ever a theme for the Dunites, it had to be eternal curiosity, and that creativity was a centerpiece of what they were doing. Everybody was an individual. There was no cult there. There was nobody orchestrating anything, but all of these independent souls believed in themselves, believed in their own art, whatever it might have been, and enjoyed the privacy that they got out there, and also the camaraderie of knowing that there are other souls much like them. I have a good friend here, Mark Whedon, who also, he's got some connections. He currently lives in the house that Ella Young lived in, and she was kind of the, I guess, godmother of the Dunites. Would that be fair?
That's correct.
Maybe you should kind of fill in some of the blanks. I'm not sure what dates you were here. Fill us in a little bit here on how you came into this story.
Sure. Well, my folks moved to Oceano from Shell Beach in 1956. And Ella Young had passed away at that time, and they were encouraged by the Grells, Gudrun and John, to purchase the property because it would be an excellent place for them. They had known the Grells for a few years ahead of that. And so they came to investigate it, and they fell in love with it, and made preparations to purchase the land, and finally did. And at that time, there were a lot of people around that wondered who they were. And so some of the people from the early days, who were friends of Gavin Arthur and Ella Young, came over time to investigate and see who they were. And while being there, they told a lot of the stories of the history of the Dunites and the area. And I, you know, by proxy, was able to learn those things myself by listening. And even when I wasn't even supposed to as a child, I'd be hiding and listening to the stories that I heard from Dr. Gerber and his wife, who used to come over and visit my folks who lived across the street, and told the whole story of Ella Young and the Dunites and the Halcyonites and a lot of the area. So it was, I got filled in on all of these things very early.
And we also, you had mentioned Halcyon. That is also part of this story. The Varians, Theosophy,
yes.
Blavatsky. We have so many subjects. I could keep going into Joseph Campbell,
yeah.
Spielberg, Star Wars.
Yeah. Well, Ella Young knew the Varians and came here to visit them. And knew them for some time while Gavin Arthur was in Europe, and still in Europe. Ella Young had come over from Ireland ahead of him. He tried to promote her success as a Irish mythologist and lecturer here and got her associated with the right people. And she came over and was ahead of him for about a year or so, and his mother was living in Santa Barbara, and Gavin came to visit her, and Ella Young was staying there, and was a close friend of the Varians in Halcyon, and this was a long association of theirs in Ireland and also here. And so Gavin Arthur was asked to drive her up to meet the Varians when he came to visit his mother. And once having met the Varians and the other people of Helsinki, he fell in love with the area and decided after time to actually build his little community in the sand dunes. And that was the beginning of the Moy Mill idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he thought of building a community out there that was kind of self-servicing, and he said about doing it, it actually worked.
Norm, maybe you can help me on this. I had a general understanding that Gavin came out with Mrs. Grell from back east at some point, that they drove out here. Can you help me on that?
Gavin was associated with Goodwin and John Grell in Martha's Vineyard.
Ah.
Now, what the connection was, I don't know. He knew them and had told them he had this property out here, and they all agreed to come out here and see it. And I'm not really clear on what his circumstances were at that time. I know he was heir to a lot of the fortune of President Arthur's tour of duty as 21st President of the United States. That's Chester Allen Arthur the First. And those inheritances were kind of sporadic, and he at times would run kind of low on money. I think this was one of those times. I do know that they came together and were here, and that ultimately he sold off his properties where you live, and where it turns out I live too, just half a block away from you. He sold that whole parcel off and went to San Francisco, where he became one of the great characters in San Francisco. Herb Cain in the Chronicle wrote about him quite frequently, at least weekly. I have a collection of the letters and articles about Gavin Arthur that were written by Herb Cain. But meanwhile, Goodwin and John stayed on, and during that time period is when they came to know the Whedon family quite well. So I have something I would like Mark to kind of tell about Ella Thorpe Ellis, who lived in the dunes at Moy Mell, which was the colony, and her father was the associate editor of the Dune Forum, the magazine they published out there. And her and I had conversation by phone and a lot of email in later years on her writings. She wrote considerably about the area, and most of it's for younger readers, but they give a good insight as to what the life and times was in Oceano during her young years. She stayed a lot with the Gerbers between there and Moy Mell. In later years, she didn't travel much, but she wanted to go to the dunes one last time, and Mark can tell you a story about that.
Well, while being a docent at the Oceano Depot Museum, I had known Ella for some years before this, and she called me and suggested that she come over with Eleanor Shumway from Halcyon and visit the depot and have a tour. And so Eleanor left her off at the depot with me, and we began our tour, and she said, "Mark, I've seen a lot of old buildings, and I'm not really all that much interested in this one. But one thing I would like very much for you to do, if you would be to drive me out to Moy Mell, and I could have another look at it." I said, "Well, Ella, that's fine. Let's do that." So we made preparations to take my original vintage dune buggy from the 1950s and trailer it down. And Ella and I got in that dune buggy and drove out into the dunes up and above Moy Mell. And she was able to oversee what was left of Moy Mell. And while we were there, she was telling a lot of the stories of who, where, and what, and pointing them out, you know, in the areas that were now covered by sand pretty well. And I said, "Well, Ella, I'm just going to leave you sit here for a while, and enjoy the place, and I'll walk off and let you kind of harmonize with everything. And so she sat there for a while, and then I came back, and we were discussing, you know, who lived where and what they did. And she said, you know, Mark, of all the places I've been all over the world, this was the only place I ever considered as my home. And so this being probably my last trip here, I am truly enjoying it. And so after that, we drove around there to some of the little coves, the little areas where the Dunites lived, and inspected them, what was left of them. And then we came home.
I'd like to add to this that Ella Thorpe Ellis has written her own book on the dunes and some of the Dunites, and called Dune Child. I'm not sure of the publisher, but you can Google it up. And she describes her life at Moy-Mel, and a lot of the things that happened at Moy-Mel though I was never privy to, because she had actually lived there as a kid and remembered quite vividly her experiences, but it makes for a pretty fine read. So if you kind of want to dig a little deeper into the Dune story, she's the one who will kind of open the window for what was going on at Moy-Mel.
Absolutely. I can vouch for that. It was very well done.
I read that book twice, and I loved it. And you really felt she did a good job in helping you to plant yourself inside of that little girl. And she had some health problems that I'm not going to be a spoiler here, but she overcame all of that. But it was a hard time for her, for a little girl. And what a great book. And I believe, weren't they doing Dune Child as a oral reading at the Odd Fellows hall?
Yes,
here?
The South County Historical Society is doing they call it a reader's theater. And what they're doing is taking a lot of these vignettes, some of them are stories from my own work, and they have readers who read, and they're strictly on the air. In fact, they said it would be okay if we aired some of these on this program, which I think would be a fine thing to do. But yeah, they did a rendition of Dune Child. They've done it 2 years in a row that I know of, so it's quite popular.
And her dad, what was his relationship? I used to say campaign manager. Maybe that was too strong a word for Upton Sinclair, who launched his bid for the governorship of California in San Luis Obispo, I believe.
Yes, they, during that time period, during the Moy-Mel era, the magazine was that they had, the Dune Forum, focused on politics and aesthetics and philosophy and poetry. And the politics was all very much a New Deal, considerably to the left of center. And, of course, Gavin supported Upton Sinclair in his bid for governor of California. And so he did assist him in doing some of the campaigning. They lived out of a truck and went up and down the state, you know, beating the drum for the right cause. And that was the relationship. And then Dunham Thorpe, Ella Thorpe Ellis's father, he was part of that too. He assisted in that respect. And then through him, they published a complete digest of Upton Sinclair's program, the EPIC program, which is an acronym for End Poverty in California. And so that whole thing it can be read in the Dune forums, which are available online. There's only six of them. The magazine ran in 1933 through 1934, but they have since been put on the website, the South County Historical website. So if you just look under South County, you'll see Dune Forum, and you can read a lot about what was Moy-Mel was really all about as far as the magazine goes.
There's some really incredible pieces inside of that Dune Forum, including a work by John Cage, who was, in a large way, American avant-garde music spearhead. And much of what he was doing was an intermingling with the man called Henry Cowell, who grew up in this area and was at least one half of the Dune Spirit Festival that we did here in Oceano, Grover Beach, and in Halcyon. And Henry Cowell was the one who taught John Cage about setting up a piano with bolts and pieces of glass in between the strings in order to create a discordant sound that he felt was connected to mythology in some kind of way. And I have a Smithsonian copy of some of his works, and it's all with an understanding that there's another world and that there's sounds that open up those portals to people. So, like I said, it's hard to stay on the same page once you start talking about the Dunites. You could go almost anywhere. I also noticed that, as I was saying, if you know about Howard Zinn, who did the People's History of the United States, well, much of what the Dunites were about was that kind of history, that taking charge of your own lives rather than pushing off responsibility to others was, I think, a keynote. And if you remember, Huell Hauser came out here and actually walked through the dunes with Norm and Elwood Decker and talked about things, and it's a piece of insight to the gentility of Elwood, but the clarity of Elwood as well. And it certainly sparked my interest. I got to know him for a good number of years as Gudrun Grell brought him back from, I believe they were in, were they in Oklahoma when she brought him back, or had they moved down to L.A.? And
They moved here from Oklahoma.
Okay, yes, from that ashram.
Kind of an interesting way that happened was Elwood became enamored of this Hindu saint, Ananda Mayi, and they had an ashram in Oklahoma City that was dedicated to her, and Elwood was interested in that, and they moved from Hollywood. They had gone to Hollywood in 1946 and met Elwood in the dunes and wanted him to come with her. And he said, I can't do that because I'm a hermit. And she said, I am too. We can be hermits in the city. Well, he was convinced. So they went to Hollywood, and there's lots of stories about her affiliation with the people in Hollywood. She was a hairdresser and had salons and stuff and got to know a lot of those people on first-person basis. So in time, though, Elwood became deeper involved in this Ananda Mayi, and there's stories about how that occurred, which we don't have time for here now. But they moved to Oklahoma City, and they were attending the ashram and doing the Kali Pujas and the whole thing. And I have a book written by the abbot of the monastery, and he, for some reason, all of a sudden, decided he wanted to go to Eastern Orthodox Catholicism. Why? I don't know. I read his book. I still don't know. But Elwood and Anne were left high and dry there with their belief structure and what they were trying to be in their association with the ashram. And it was right about then that I was turning stones trying to get the story on the Dunites. And Dr. Gerber was still in contact with a lot of these people through postcards and letters. Back then, they didn't have email. And so he asked Elwood if it would be okay if I contacted him. And he said, yes, I contacted him. They were ready for moving back here. And they did. So they moved back here to Arroyo Grande. And then from there, ultimately, to the Grell property, which is where you're talking about when you met him when they were on the Grell property.
I met them when they were in the apartments first while Anne was still with us.
Ah, okay.
And Carl Kempton and his wife, Ruth, were also at that meeting. And they ended up kind of taking Elwood under their wing for many years, as well as Elwood moved up to Mrs. Grell's place after Ann passed away. And I'm hoping to bring them on a kind of regular basis, because they're living and breathing art, and that's what Elwood was about. That, I have to say about Elwood, that's the only person I've ever met without an ego. He really was pure art.
Yeah, his art was supposed, his focus was his art being a pathway to God, mm-hmm. and he was very serious about it.
Yeah.
So some of it was pretty esoteric and not instantly recognizable as far as representationalism goes. And so because of that, on the back, he wrote what it would be, you know, time scattering bubbles of illusion to entertain and instruct children like us. That's very typical of what he would do. And he'd flip it back and forth, and all of a sudden, you have it.
Yeah. He used to have a sign on his door that said, "Be back soon." And then you flipped it over and it said, "Maybe." And isn't that true?
He had another one pinned up over the archway inside between the kitchen and the living room that I liked. Somebody had given him a television, and he kind of watched it off and on, and when it went off, quit working, he decided he didn't need it, and so pinned above the doorway was a sign that says, I still have this sign, "Life is my TV."
He had another sign, and it took me a while to figure out what that meant. It said, "No students with or without bags," and it was something he saw down at 7-Eleven, and that when the elementary school would let out, all the kids would run down there and buy candy, and I guess they got to the point where they couldn't keep an eye on enough kids, so they had a sign outside that, you know, basically regulated the amount of students in at one time. And he got a kick out of that, and he did a fluorescent sign out of that. Elwood was also, to me, he represented so much. He would take off. I mean, he was total creativity. As he got older, he used to take off from Mrs. Grell's place and go hitchhiking around the country. And commonly, somebody would get a phone call down here saying, "We're in the state of Washington, and we have a man here, da-da-da-da-da-da-da." And we'd say, "Yeah, it's not uncommon, but I'm sure he'll find his way back if you give him a little bit of direction." And it seemed like every time he came back from one of those long tours, I would end up meeting him in the parking lot over there at Thrifty's. And the first thing he did was get into Thrifty's and get some of their ice cream.
He loved that Häagen-Dazs ice cream.
Yep.
Lived on that stuff.
Yeah. He always told me about his trips. He said, "Oh, Charlie, it was so wonderful. I slept out on the side of the road underneath the stars and had such a great time." And he always did. He was able to make gold out of whatever his experience was. And he had a wide range of genres of art that he dabbled in. And he was respected by people in the abstract art film of California. And he was good friends with Oscar Feischinger. And that association alone should be delved into. That's going to take a couple of different shows if you know who Oscar Feischinger was. But his art was way out ahead of most artists. He was doing what we would think of as computer art before there were computers, 3D kind of visualizations. And I think a lot of it was kind of... maybe I'm going out there too far, but mescaline oriented. And he was, Oscar Feischinger was out here working on Fantasia, I believe, and ran into some problems with Disney and the way he wanted the music and color to go. Can you say anything about that period of time, Norm?
I'm not real familiar with Oscar Feisinger's work, but no, I know he that Elwood did exhibit with Man Ray in Hollywood. And, of course, this goes back to when Man Ray was still kind of cutting his teeth also. But they all knew each other. There's a small circle of people there who are working in that direction in the abstract arena. So, yeah.
And Man Ray was a painter, but also a photographer. And I know that many people don't realize that Elwood exhibited with Man Ray and was doing something very similar to what Man Ray was doing, placing objects on film and letting them develop. I'm not sure what he called them, but Elwood called his photograms. And we have a stack of these, and some of them are actually exhibited on our website, a hole in the sky.com. Norm was able to set that up, and you can watch about a dozen of them flash before your eyes, and the texture that is derived from those it leaves you scratching your head, wondering where did this come from? Who would have ever put these unbelievable collections together, all in one piece of art? So that we will explore even more in depth in other shows, and we'll bring in some experts on Man Ray and Oscar Feisinger, because that's the last thing I should be putting myself off as. I'm lucky when I can hold a pencil and write, never mind the kind of things that these people do. Mark, you have experiences in the dunes with even Merle Fankhauser, if I remember. We were talking about dune buggies and...
Merle Fankhauser back in the early 1960s was kind of the hot rod king of the area. Him and his father made some beautiful custom hot rods, and it would be nothing all of a sudden to see Merle appear in the driveway with some beautiful 40 Ford coupe with red candy apple lacquer on it all, and say, "Hey, Mark, look at this neat car that we built." And he'd have another one maybe in another year, and he had all these wonderful things. Besides being a musician and a musical artist, he and my brother had a band together in the early days, and Merle went on to pursue a career in it. So that was very interesting knowing him and watching him develop over the years.
And Merle's been a big part of our radio station, even way back in the first incarnation of excellent radio, and still today. And for me, he's kind of a high desert connection. Everybody wants to rub elbows with important people. Well, the high desert had plenty of it, and Captain Beefheart was up there, and that was connected to Zappa, and that was connected to Varese, and next thing you know, we're connecting it back to Henry Cowell, and the world just gets bigger and bigger as you start to explore through the connections here with the Dunites. So, and Henry Cowell, to me, was the originator of world beat music, even though you wouldn't have called it that at the time. He was giving credence to other world's classical forms of music, stuff that you would think was just a hodgepodge.
Well, he was extremely well known all over the world as time went by. And he came up with the discordant music, which was very popular, I believe, in the 1930s when they started that, which kind of defied a lot of the standards that were going on then. And it became like a whole group of followers behind that very quickly.
Yeah. I came to find out about Halcyon, Theosophy, and those kind of things in a roundabout way. There used to be a place called Mims Antiques, and a man named Leo, I can't think of his last
name. Kotarski.
Yeah, that's why I couldn't remember that name. He used to let me hang out there. When I got out of the service and I was doing floors and windows and stuff, during the winter time, there wasn't that much work. So I would drift over there, and he would allow me to go through his compound, which was a bunch of buildings that were all linked together. And he used to go over to England and bring back whole lots, I mean literal lots, of furniture and books. And a lot of it leaned towards theosophy, but it was early renditions. For another maybe 10 years, I didn't even know the word theosophy, but I found Cyril Scott's book, which was called The Secret Influence of Music Throughout the Ages. And if I was to quickly boil that down, what he was saying was that mankind is divided, and like they say in the Bible, through languages, but he was saying that musically, the different chakra levels corresponds to different communities throughout the world, and until all of those come back together, we'll never have a full understanding of what sound really should be doing as far as a magical portal to finding out information that visibly isn't available in this world. So it was through Cyril Scott that I started to find out about theosophy, and he also wrote a number of books called The Initiate, which was supposedly channeled. Katumi or Saint Germain channeled those books through to him, and I started reading them, and I recognized man's plight to know more about where he lived in this planet and in the metaphysical world. And it opened me up to the fact that Halcyon was right on the border of where I lived, and I didn't even realize that that this even existed. And next thing I know, I'm finding out about the Varians, and that Halcyon was an art center in the early 1920s or so.
20s, yeah.
And that there were many other connections that I should know about. So my own investigations wasn't really aimed at where I landed. It was in the periphery that I came to find out about these things, and I guess you could say that's an organic understanding. I wasn't trying to push an idea. It just all developed in front of me.
Well, you certainly were in the right place, because Leo Gutorsky was very interested in theosophy, as well as being a Mason of high degree.
Yeah.
He was very interested in theosophy and was constantly inquiring into it.
I can remember in the store, he had a whole series of books on masonry, and they were all leather bound, and they were all gold embossed, the titles and stuff, with his name on them. Yeah. I still puzzle about that, but he was that kind of a guy. He, when Mem died, I talked to him, and he had a mobile home on that property,
mm-hmm.
and she had died out in the yard there somewhere, and then after she died, he moved the trailer, wasn't too far away, to where he slept over the very spot where she died. I always thought that was poignant. I always thought that was really nice.
You also told me another story about her background and
the whip.
Do you remember that?
I didn't see the whip.
You didn't see it, but
no.
You heard the story. Did?
Well, I have the whip.
Oh, my God. Tell the story.
It's very interesting because Mims was the daughter of a Texas Ranger originally, and she had learned as a youth to use a whip, a bull whip, very well, mm-hmm. with tremendous accuracy. And at one point, someone attempted to rob them and didn't notice that she was in the store and had the whip to her avail. And she whipped the gun right out of his hand, and it landed on the floor, and then he ran away.
Yeah.
And but she was a very, very tough gal. I mean, the real thing. And she took good care of Leo, you know.
Yeah.
Anything that he was unable to do himself, she could cover it, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that'll definitely be in the movie, I'm sure. They don't leave out those action parts.
No,
you can't leave that one out.
No.
That's
no.
Too good.
And she had a southern accent, and she would say, well, hello there, young man. How are you doing today?
Yeah.
You know, and we passed as children, you know, and have a little conversation with us, and she was quite a gal.
I still have some of the books I got from him, and we also bought a dresser from him that I'm continuing to use. So, yep, deep dish. That's the Do Night story for sure. Are there any people you'd like to, because we've only got about 15 minutes left. All of a sudden we've blabbed ourselves through 45 minutes of blabbing. And are there some major characters that you think we should be covering in the future here?
I think what we should cover right now is there was one of the Dunites, Bryn Bjorst.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark knew him, got to know him, because he came to visit the Gerbers on a pretty regular basis. And Mark has a pretty good imitation of him.
Oh, I won't get into that. So, my imitations get me into all kinds of trouble, so I'm going to be careful about that. But Bryn used to come and visit Dr. Gerber, and Dr. Gerber would have evenings where he would entertain a number of guests, yeah. And there'd be a lot of celebrities there. Gavin Arthur, a lot of different people would show up at these, and they're quite full of liveliness. Dr. Gerber was a very lively person himself and told numerous interesting stories of the Dunites and lit everyone's evening up very well. But Bryn would come with his wife, and they would sit down, and his wife never did say too much while we were there, but Bryn would talk about his days in the Norwegian underground during World War II and the fighting of the Nazis and getting them out of Norway and some of his exploits then. And he was quite a philosopher, an author, and he was a person who was very interested in trying to have a type of, instead of the currency that we use presently, a whole different system, a monetary system. And he wrote a book on the subject. I forget what it's called. Do you remember, Norm?
He wrote quite a few books. The one that comes to mind is Fairy Tales Are True.
Yes, that's
true. And in there he talks about his adventures in India and experiences in the different lamaseries and that sort of thing. And then also his time as a Dunite. And he lived in the dunes before the war and did the part you're talking about when he went to... Because he was a Norwegian, and he went back to Norway to kind of fight the Nazis and that sort of stuff. The book has been reprinted. In fact, I think all of his books have been reprinted now, so they are available. That particular book is my favorite, Fairy Tales Are True.
And I remember some of the characters that were in that book were people that came over from the Orient and spent time with them in this area and in Helsinki during that. And it would be very interesting for a person to read that because they went in depth of all kinds of different philosophical issues and what have you, you know, that were part of his whole life form, you know, that he had had for years. And, you know, the getting to know of some of these figures from India and having them come here was really a special point in his life. And he discusses that in his book.
And Ella Young, I'm not specifically sure what her place was in California as an educator. Can you fill me in? I know she had written some books and was, I believe, on the Board of Regents or something.
She
like
was
that.
In Berkeley. She was. Yeah. She taught at Berkeley. And some of her students have come down through the years still inquiring about her, and Mark knows a little bit about some of these people who, you know, want to access artifacts, pictures, photographs, stories, anything connected with Ella Young, and her popularity is increasing, and she wrote over a dozen books that I know of about Irish and Gaelic folklore and mythology, plus her own autobiography. Can't remember the title of it now.
Flowering Dusk.
Flowering Dusk. Yeah. And those have all been reprinted and are available.
And we had them here during our, I think we had two major Do Night festivals here. And we had those books laid out. And it seems like one of them was like a children's book aimed at children.
Some of them were. Yeah, some of them definitely were. Some of them were pretty heavy. You had to kind of be versed in mythology to kind of do them. But her whole focus was the thing that was going on between of the British and the Irish after Cromwell and all that whole business up into the Easter Rebellion of around 1916. And that's when things started getting hot for her, and she moved out and came to America. I think Gavin Arthur assisted her in that regard because they met and knew each other in Ireland. But so, yeah, those books are all still available.
The main book, if you want to know of her own history, is that autobiography of hers, which would be Flowering Dusk, which tells all of what Norm just mentioned about the days of the Sinn Féin in Ireland and her association with Gavin Arthur there and her association with the Varians here and her life in Halcyon, as well as Oceano. So it would be a good one if anyone is interested in her history to have or read.
And all of this is so legitimate. It's not just us talking about people who happen to be in the area. These people had effects on the future of America and the way that it went. And it seems to me like we're getting a second crack at that right now, as a matter of fact. We have the Do Night themed mural out here, but it's we're living in a time when getting some of the basic knowledge that it takes to live and appreciate life and appreciate the planet is in necessity right now. And so as we are bringing out these issues in upcoming shows, we really feel like it's not just telling a story that, you know, put your feet up and light up a cigar or something in front of a fire, but there's information about to be passed that we can use, that our children can use as well. So.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, Gavin Arthur, after coming here to visit with Ella Young to visit the Varians, who were a priest and priestess of the temple of the people in Halcyon, he fell in love with the area and everyone here. And this was his idea that as he his inheritances would be less when he was, you know, in his early 30s, and he would have to live without them. So he decided to see if he could build like a utopian community, or at least an area in the dunes. And this is what started the idea of Moymel. Mm-hmm. And so while here, he decided to build a little cabin, which is now at the Oceano Depot that we've been able to save.
Thanks to you. And
yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. And so in any event, he decided to build this cabin there. He and his friend, what was his friend?
Carl Beckstead.
Carl Beckstead, yeah. He and Carl built the cabin out there, and he lived there for years. And Ella Young came out, and they did a special ceremony of what they called the Four Jewels. And, you know, having to do with all it, and we'll enter into the Four Jewels as a separate subject some other time, but they did the ceremony of the Four Jewels to initiate the place out there. And Ella Young was very much involved in it and enjoyed the whole idea of it. And over the years, Gavin had a lot of many celebrities and many interesting people come and visit the place in the dunes. And it was considered as a sacred place by them.
Mm-hmm. Gavin also had another, foothold on history with his book called Circle of Sex, where he was saying, you know, don't interpret people as one or the other. There's a little bit of male and female in everybody, and everybody realizes that now. You bring males are more likely to bring out their feminine aspects in their life in order to create a balance. And he was saying the same thing, that we shouldn't be judging people on a straight-ahead basis, but instead variations of any of those themes is totally acceptable. And he had somewhat of a clock on the front of his book that broke down, certain aspects of personalities, would you say?
There was in the circle of sex, there's 12 sexual categories, and they run the full gamut from 100% homosexuality to 100% homosexuality, heterosexuality, homosexuality. Yeah. And there's another pivot point where you have the most yin and the most yang, yin being the female and the yang being the male. And it's all the interspersion of fractions of qualities in those 12 categories. And there's another lost work where he described how we migrate through these sexual categories at will, and sometimes through the signs of the particular signs of the zodiac that we're connected with. He was also an astrologer, and that was really one of the, those, his two main passions in life at the basis of it all was human sexuality and astrology. And so Circle of Sex was part of that, those two things that he put together. So,
and you're an astrologer, astronomer, or astro. How would you describe what you've done with solstice sites?
It's astronomy. It's a basic, they call it archaeoastronomy, and that's where you record evidence of ancient peoples trying to describe events that happen in the sky, which is primarily the equinoxes and the sun, solstices, summer and winter solstice. And I found a number of sites and documented them and done some papers on that. But yeah, it's strictly astronomy. It's totally different than astrology, although historically and back in antiquity, they were they worked together. They've only separated in recent years. One is more science. The other one is regarded as more pseudoscience, but I'll let somebody else pass judgment on that.
Well, I think we were very lucky that somebody like you decided to dig up the Dunites, and you have enough knowledge or interest in areas that I don't know where else we would go. And your new book about Elwood employs a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's an e-book on Elwood Decker.
Which is a masterpiece.
It's a Kindle book. I'm not selling books here, but you, if you're interested in more information on the Dunites, a lot of stuff keeps coming in, and from 1992 until I published Elwood's book online, I was able to sweep a lot of that into Elwood's book because he was part of it. He was in the middle of it and part of it. So if you're interested, it costs less than a bottle of beer at Old Juan's Cantina, which is my favorite watering hole.
And I believe inside of that book is also a breakdown of Elwood's idea of abstract art course, which you do an excellent job in making it accessible to people that don't know anything about art. So thank you for that, and I hope that's a plug that will get you to sell some books and increase the knowledge of the audience that's going to be joining us whenever we do these shows. And this show will go on to our archive page at kyxz.org so that others can review it and spread it and maybe bring in even more information. I expect that's really what's going to happen, that we're once again pulling back the rug that more people can help us with this show. Well, we're pretty much there. I'm just afraid that we might delve into Ansel Adams and Edward Weston if we're not careful.
We can't get that started now.
Well, one thing you have to remember is Gavin Arthur was an expert at starting arguments, and some of the nights at my mill were fraught with all kinds of arguments all the way through until daylight.
Yeah.
Yeah, his motto was, "Let's you and him fight."
That's it. And he could jump on the other side if he ran out of room.
When it suited his purpose, he did.
Wow. Well, let's go ahead and kind of close her out here. And once again, if you go to our website, you will be able to find the archive of this. Can you give me... Oh, and also here at Hole in the Sky, we have your first book about the Dunites available. And everybody who gets that just cherishes that book. And you really get it's like pulling a soft blanket over you as you read it. You definitely are a Dunite by the time you read that thing. But Gavin Arthur said you don't have to live in the dunes to be a Dunite. So if you're an adventurous person and you would like to meet some of the people that might have spawned somebody like you, directly or indirectly, then this is the show that you might want to be tapping into on a regular basis. So I want to thank Mark Whedon for coming in here. And by the way, Mark was a major reason that we have a broadcast tower for excellent radio. He went so far beyond what normal volunteers would do. I can't even tell you. He donated the tower. Got this gigantic steel plate put on the thing so that we could erect it. He got Louis Crane to come over and drop that thing in. And all of that was just a plain miracle. We microwave our signal up to the Mesa, and we would have been microwaving that signal into outer space if it wasn't for you, Mark. Thank you very much for that huge effort.
You're very welcome.
And you're also a big volunteer at the Vets Hall, and you will say a little bit about what you do with the memorabilia of World War II and veterans.
I like to see to it that our soldiers and the time they spent defending the country are not forgotten. There's a lot of politics and nasty business that's kind of conditioned this, and all I can say is God bless the people that served to fight off some very vicious enemies that we've had in the past and still do behind the scenes.
And at one point, we'll be playing Mrs. Grell's piece called 5 Years I Shall Never Forget, about her fighting the Nazis while in Denmark during the occupation of Denmark by the Nazis. And as you listen to her voice, you really feel like all is lost in the beginning, and you wonder, how can we ever get this person through this story to a happy ending? And we know she lived, but you would think it would be impossible. And from that story, I think we should take hope. We're up against the wall right now, environmentally, a lot of, and politically right now, where it seems like everything's divided and there's no clear answer. Well, there were worse times than this, believe it or not, and somehow mankind has made it through. So there's a lot to embrace yourself with the Dunite story. So don't forget this, and tune it in, tell other people, pick up some of the books. There was a recent article in the Telegram Tribune about Moy Mel and the Dunites and Elwood. And, just Google Dunites. It will be fascinating. You'll see.
The first time I ever read Norm Hammond's book on the Dunites, my mother sent me a copy of it when I was living in Florida. And when I finally finished it, I was disappointed because I wanted to read it all over again. It was so well done.
Yeah.
So you must read that.
Well, we're pretty darn lucky to have both of you here. Thank you so much. And some other major speakers, including David Chaffardini, who had a lot to do with the exploration of Dunites. He will be here eventually, too. He's off on a big trip right now and was really sad he couldn't be here. But he will be here and offering more insight. We got some insight, that's for sure. All right, I'm going to give it up to the birds, bring up some music in a little bit here, and hope you enjoyed this little, I think we should call it Dune Spirit. Does that sound okay?
I think that's
guys?
Fitting. Yes.
Yeah, good.
It
mm-hmm.
certainly covers quite a
that's
bit.
That's fitting. Yeah.
All righty. All right, it's you and me and the birds at this point. Don't go too far away. It's excellent radio, and that is KYXZ LP 1079 Grover Beach, California. Thank you for listening.